This is Barbara Leslie, President of the Oakland Port Commission. Oakland International Airport, OAK, is proud to bring you this podcast of KQED's Forum. When you're choosing your next adventure, the smart and convenient choice is to fly the East Bay Way from OAK to destinations across the USA and Mexico. And when you return home, tune in to KQED, always bringing us remarkable stories about who we are and where we live. Enjoy today's episode of Forum.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
From KQED.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Alexis Madrigal. Those of us in the Bay Area have almost certainly seen a building designed by Julia Morgan, one of our area's most prolific and best architects. She was a groundbreaking woman in a field that to this very day remains dominated by men. From her first commission, the Campanile Bell Tower at Mills College, to the Arts and Crafts Asilomar and the Gothic and Moorish Berkeley City Club, the Oakland-raised architect created many of California's most distinctive buildings. That includes, of course, Hearst Castle, which dominated the later years of her career. We'll talk about her life and work with the author of a new book, Julia Morgan, an intimate biography of the trailblazing architect. Welcome to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Julia Morgan is best known as the architect of the opulent, eccentric Hearst Castle, but she designed roughly 700 buildings in her 50-year career. From the very first time I saw the gorgeous pool at the Berkeley City Club, I was taken by the gracefulness of her work, the way the arches of that space work together with the beams and the ceiling and the windows along one edge to deliver this feeling of sanctuary, serenity, beauty. But despite the quality and quantity of Morgan's work, for most of the last century, she has not received the sort of critical or popular attention one might expect. That is changing, a bit at least, and the latest sign is the publication of a gorgeously illustrated book by our guest this morning, Victoria Kastner, who was the official historian at Hearst Castle for 30 years. The title is Julia Morgan, An Intimate Biography of the Trailblazing Architect. Welcome to the show, Victoria.
Thanks, Alexis.
So can we talk about how many barriers that Julia Morgan broke through? Like, it feels in reading your book like she was almost the first woman to do almost everything in architecture in California.
Well, I agree with you. It seems like she was always the only woman kind of on every building site or in every group photograph that we have or, you know, wherever she went, she pretty much was the only woman.
And what do you think was special about Julia Morgan that allowed her to navigate this extremely sexist world?
Well, she had a remarkable amount of drive and dedication as well as intelligence and creative ability. And she just didn't believe that anything was impossible. She also put a great store in the fact that she was a Californian. She said, "I consider myself very fortunate to practice architecture in the area where I grew up," because most of the great architects that we think of in the first part of the 20th century, Alexis, were, transplants. Bernard Maybeck and John Galen Howard were New Yorkers. The Green brothers, Charles and Henry, who did buildings in the South Bay as well as in Berkeley. They were born in Cincinnati, grew up in St. Louis. So she really was a native Californian. She was born in San Francisco and then grew up in Oakland. And I think she had a special appreciation for her state, the landscape, the history of the area where she worked.
Yeah. And, you know, I think it's fair to note that she did have a tremendous amount of privilege in her life and a lot of financial resources and cultural resources via her family. Tell us a little bit about that background and how she grew up in Oakland.
That was true. She was raised really around beauty, and she was raised in some affluence. Her parents were both Easterners. They'd grown up in Brooklyn Heights, married there, and then settled in California. And her maternal grandparents were quite wealthy. Her grandfather was a cotton broker before and after the Civil War. And while her mother had a lot of drive, her father had a lot of enthusiasm, but he wasn't always a successful at, you know, turning it into actual events. He was unsuccessful as a businessman, and so her family were often financed, actually, with assistance from her maternal grandparents.
Mm. And her educational background, right? She goes to Berkeley and studies there. But feels like the big change in her career comes when she gets put through the gauntlet of elite French education. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, she went to Oakland High School and thought about medicine and thought about music, but she loved architecture, and her second cousin had married a famous architect in New York. His name was Pierre Lebrun, and his MetLife Tower building still exists on Madison Avenue in Manhattan. So she decided to study architecture. She went to Cal Berkeley, but at the time she enrolled in 1890, there wasn't an architecture department, so she graduated in civil engineering. And after she graduated, she met a man I just mentioned, the brilliant architect Bernard Maybeck, who did so many things in the Bay Area, but I like to think of him as the person who gave San Francisco its Eiffel Tower, you know, the Palace of Fine Arts, that magnificent rotunda and colonnade and lagoon that were built for the 1915 World's Fair. So she was doing taking art classes at Mark Hopkins Institute of Art, which is where the Mark Hopkins Hotel stands today on Nob Hill. And he was teaching there after she had graduated from Cal, and he saw her ability. He had gone to the world's finest school for architects. It was called the École des Beaux-Arts, the School of Fine Arts in Paris. Mm. It had been founded in 1648, basically as a feeder school for the artisans who would be the future builders of Versailles. But it had never admitted a woman. And since Maybeck had graduated from there, he told Julia that he thought she had the ability to apply and do her studies there.
Mm. And what does that education end up doing for her?
I think it changed everything in her life. He knew there was a rumor afoot, because he'd stayed in touch with his classmates and former professors, that they were going to admit women to the sculpture and painting departments. But nobody had even thought about the idea that a woman would apply to architecture. And when she did arrive in Paris, which was in 1896 when she was 24, she did what people did at that time. You joined a studio called an atelier, and you practiced, because the rigorous examination was so difficult that you had to spend a lot of time preparing for it. And even in that studio, of course, she was hazed. She wrote to her relatives, the architect Lebrun and his wife Lucy. She said about the other men in the atelier, she said, "One of them is very gentlemanly, but the others could have been replaced with no difficulty." So she was harassed from the very beginning. It was said that she had water poured over her head. She was pushed off the ends of benches. This was a place that was full of 20-year-old Frenchmen, you know, and the hazing had been a tradition for literally centuries. But what you learned to do was to enter competitions, and these competitions were really rigorous. You were given an assignment. And it was, say, design a war memorial. Then you were locked in a room for 12 hours, and you had to make a sketch and then turn it in. And 6 weeks later, you came back with these intricate, detailed, elaborate, and enormous drawings. And if in plan, section, and elevation, and if in any way your drawings diverged from what you had initially done in the first 12 hours, you were eliminated for competition. And competition was the way both that you entered the École by passing the test, and then matriculated through the program. So you had to learn how to think fast, see problems, solve them immediately, create harmony, but then also be internally consistent and work on an incredible deadline. And I think she really imbibed all of those traditions.
We're talking with the author Victoria Kastner about her new book, Julia Morgan, an intimate biography of the trailblazing architect. Here in the Bay Area, we are blessed with many Julia Morgan buildings, and we want to hear from you. What's your favorite Julia Morgan building? I already gave away my favorite room designed by Julia Morgan. It's the pool at the Berkeley City Club. But people, opinions will diverge. You can give us a call. The number is 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, we're KQED Forum, and the email is forum@kqed.org. So she comes through this grueling education. She comes back to the United States. And who are her clients going to be? Like, what are, there are other female architects in California, but what are the things that they're hired to design?
You're quite right. She was not the first one, and there were other others, not many, but there were others. She was the first female architect to be licensed, officially licensed, and that happened 2 years after her return in March 1904 in the state of California. But what made her really different, Alexis, is that instead of building what most female architects of that time did, maybe kitchen remodels, a few houses, perhaps women's clubs, she did those things. But she also designed schools, churches, hotels, and massive estates, as you know, for William Randolph Hearst, as well as other clients. And so she competed in a man's world, and she was one of really a handful of architects in the Bay Area who had actually gotten a degree from the world's finest program. So she actually was meeting, you know, colleagues and clients at a high level. There are very few architects, as a matter of fact, in American history who've built on the scale that Julia Morgan did. They would be Stanford White and Richard Morris Hunt. He designed the Biltmore in North Carolina, in Asheville, and Stanford White, many great private estates on the East Coast. But she's decades younger than they are, and she's working in this, you know, Gilded Age style of elegance, as well as designing things like the playhouse for the taxi driver's daughter. She got to know the taxi driver well when he drove her from San Luis Obispo train station to San Simeon back and forth, literally hundreds of times. Mm. So whatever she built, she put her whole heart and attention into, and every project was equally important to her.
And she also was innovative with the new materials of the time, in particular reinforced concrete, yeah?
That's very true. It was pioneered. I mean, you know, the Romans used it, but then it was forgotten for millennia. It was pioneered really as a structural material at the École des Beaux-Arts. And so she really did understand engineering. She didn't engineer all of her buildings, but she worked very closely with those who did. And she worked very hard in the beginning, as you mentioned, on El Campanile. That's the bell tower at Mills, the Oakland College that we in the Bay Area know so well. It was 72 feet high. It was steel reinforced concrete. She finished it in 1904, and that was among her earliest commissions. It was impressive then, but much more impressive 2 years later when it survived the 1906 earthquake without a single crack in it.
Mm. And that made her kind of a hot architect at that time, right? Because people needed to reconstruct an enormous portion of San Francisco.
That is so true. Hundreds and hundreds of the city were decimated, both by earthquake and by fire. And that included Julia's office. She had been working for the architect who was building the redesigned University of California, John Galen Howard. And with him, she moved to San Francisco, and her office was at 456 Montgomery in the first couple of years. And that was blown up, part of the dynamiting that happened to try to stop the fires that were ravaging the city. So she, in 1906, she lost all of her records and papers just soon after she had really started an independent practice. But she was hired, because I think of El Campanile and its success, to redesign the Fairmont Hotel on Nob Hill. It was a brand new building that had been really not only gutted by fire in the post-earthquake, but its foundations had actually moved 7 feet. And mm-hmm. It was a complete empty shell, and many people didn't think it could even be restored.
Wow.
But
she
was
built it
in
a year, right?
That's right. And she re-engineered it. It had already been designed and was just weeks away from opening. So she re-engineered it. And that was 1 year to the day after the 06 earthquake, the first building to come back, and a tremendous success that made her quite well-known among San Franciscans.
Amazing. We're talking with Victoria Kastner. She's the author of a new book, Julia Morgan, an intimate biography of the trailblazing architect. And we're going to start taking some of your calls right after the break about what your favorite Julia Morgan building is. Number's 866-733-6786 or the email's forum at kqed.org. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned for more right after the break.
This is Barbara Leslie, president of the Oakland Port Commission. Oakland International Airport, OAK, is proud to bring you this podcast of KQED's Forum. When you're choosing your next adventure, the smart and convenient choice is to fly the East Bay Way from OAK to destinations across the USA and Mexico. And when you return home, tune in to KQED, always bringing us remarkable stories about who we are and where we live. Enjoy today's episode of Forum.
Support for Forum is sponsored by Stanford's Master of Liberal Arts program. Have you found yourself reflecting on your life and education? Perhaps you think it's too late or you're too busy to earn a master's degree. Stanford's part-time MLA program is designed for anyone, from recent college grads to retirees who'd like to pursue an interdisciplinary course of study in the liberal arts. MLA students also enjoy access to the world-class facilities on the Stanford campus. Information session held May 16th. Learn more at mla.stanford.edu.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We're talking with author Victoria Kastner about her new book, Julia Morgan, An Intimate Biography of the Trailblazing Architect. And we're talking with you about your favorite Julia Morgan buildings. Let's bring in our first caller, Jamila in Berkeley. Welcome.
Hi there. My name's Jamila. I spent more than 10 years teaching water exercise in the Hearst Gymnasium at UC Berkeley campus. And the pool that we were able to use, there's actually three pools in that building, was only accessible through the women's locker room. So it ended up being a women's only class. And we found so much community and solace just being together over that time. And people in the class had been there many years before I became part of it. We celebrated 80th birthdays, baby showers, all kinds of things. And I think it was really, truly in large part due to the fact that we were in this absolutely gorgeous kind of sacred space that Julia Morgan created. And I just wanted to ask the author if she had any sense of, I've heard that this building, Hearst Gymnasium, is actually slated for demolition. And I'm wondering if you have any knowledge of that and whether or not that's even legal, given that it's a historic building landmark.
Yeah, we will try and answer that. Hold that thought for one sec, though. I just want to know what you loved about the building itself. Like, what did you think when you would go inside this thing, and what kind of caught your eye?
Well, I mean, all of the details are absolutely gorgeous, and also the materials that were used. So the pool is made out of marble, and there are like sculptures around there that are cast concrete. It's just not a kind of environment that you find every day. I mean, it's very rare to find. Mm-hmm. And I think that it really had an impact on our community. You know, people just felt so happy to be there. It felt like a sanctuary. And even though it was just on Bancroft Way, there was a hedge around the front that just made it feel like we're in a private oasis. Mm. Just absolutely stunning.
I love that. Sacred space, sanctuary, really beautiful. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Jamila. And Victoria, what do you know about the preservation or lack thereof of this gymnasium?
Jamila, I'm so glad you brought up this building, especially as the first one. It is so remarkable. When you're in that pool, which just for people who haven't seen photographs of it, resembles the outdoor pool at San Simeon because it's lined in the very same marbles. White with a green vein, green with a white vein. It has that same beautiful turquoise blue. It's very large, and when you're in it, you're looking. The campanile is looming over you, and there's a kind of vast temple, as you say, with these beautiful cast stone maidens. It's a very special structure, and I'm sorry to say that Jamila is right. As of 2018, it has been marked by university planners as a building that they have targeted for demolition. And we're certainly working to resist that, and I would refer any listener who's interested to the Berkeley Architectural Heritage Association. That's B-A-H-A, baha.org. They have a petition, and they are filing suits because it's an incredible thing to think. It's not only a beautiful building, but it is the only building that was created to memorialize Phoebe Apperson Hearst, William Randolph Hearst's mother. She's the person who really funded the University of California's redesign. It's the only building that was designed jointly by Julia Morgan and Bernard Maybeck, her great mentor. They worked on it together, and it was built as a gift to the university by William Randolph Hearst in honor of his mother. Phoebe had died in 1919. It was finished in 1927, and it is a very, very special structure.
Yeah. Man, Jamila, great call. Thank you so much. And now you know where to go for more information on that. I want to talk a little bit about Julia Morgan, the Californian. You know, you noted that the other big architects of the time were Eastern transplants. How do you think Julia's deep connection to this place actually shows up in her work?
A lot of it is about how her buildings occupy the landscape. She was always thinking about the relationship between the interior and the exterior. Matter of fact, she loved to be landscape architect as well as architect. And she was extremely practical. Many of you maybe know she did a lot of buildings in the East Bay, especially in the years after the 06 quake. We would call them that First Bay tradition, the beautiful kind of brown shingle buildings that are simple, private family homes. What she would often do, the lots were small, and so she would put the entrance not at the front of the house, but about midway down the house so that the front could just look straight out to the street, and you'd walk down a path and then enter at the middle of the building. So if you turned one way, you went to the dining room, and if you turned the other way, you went into the living room. And her buildings were incredibly practical. If there were window boxes in them, then you could be sure that there'd be a spigot so that you could turn on and water the plants without having to haul a hose anywhere. She was always incredibly thoughtful about her clients. And interestingly, because she would build what they wanted, she was obscure for many years. And then when people started discovering her in the 1980s, really, she became known. People said, well, she didn't have a style. She was just a client's architect, you know, as if that was a bad thing, that she would do what you wanted. There was a couple who didn't like right angles in the East Bay, and she actually built a house for them that didn't have any right angles. And there was a man who didn't like to get out of bed in the morning to turn on the heat, and she created a contraption so that he could still be under the covers in his bedroom and get the heater going. I mean, she would just do whatever would honor the people who were using that building. And that was true if it was college girls, you know, working out at the swimming pool, or William Randolph Hearst. Whoever you were important to her.
Let's bring in Brian in San Francisco. Welcome to the show, Brian.
Hi, Victoria. It's Brian Kenny. How are you doing?
Oh, hello, Brian.
Great book.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask you if you knew how the work broke down on the Hearst Gymnasium for women, what part Maybeck did and what part Morgan did, because there's some confusion about that.
Well, like a lot of mentor-mentee relationships, you know, when Julia was young, Maybeck, I mean, he went to Paris because he was promoting Phoebe's architectural competition. Julia lived in an apartment beneath Ben and Annie Maybeck's own apartment in Paris. He encouraged her, you know. But as they aged, she became kind of his encourager. You know, he closed his office because he was so eccentric. He wasn't a big financial success in his time. And so he designed buildings out of her office. He worked out of her office. Mm-hmm. And what he was really known for were these beautiful conceptual drawings. He would do them with pastels on brown paper. And he was excellent at creating that conception and, you know, thinking of things like these maidens that are on these beautiful urns that ornament the pool. But we know that when the building opened, the grand opening was in 1927, and William Randolph Hearst, as the donor of the building, was there. When he asked Bernard Maybeck where the men's room was, Maybeck couldn't tell him. So when it comes to the practical side of three swimming pools and all these ancillary support structures, Julia Morgan is definitely the person who's dotting all I's and crossing all T's. But they worked wonderfully well together.
Oh, that's great. Let's bring in Noah in Richmond, who wants to talk about the Saratoga Foothill Club. Welcome, Noah.
Hello, thanks for taking my call. I'm talking about the Saratoga Foothill Club in Saratoga, California, in the South Bay area near San Jose. And I'm calling because I'm actually getting married there next weekend.
Congratulations.
My wonderful fiance, Annette. Thank you very much. And one of the reasons we chose the structure is it's actually where I went to my very first wedding as a three-year-old with my aunt and uncle as the ring bearer. And of course, it's also just a gorgeous structure. You know, it's got this beautiful dark wood that creates a really cozy space inside, but also has these large windows that let you look out on a beautifully cared for garden and a trellis and courtyard. It used to be a women's club. Now it's a more general open club and venue, but it's a really it's not grandiose. It's just this combination of cozy and open to the world that I love.
Yeah. Oh, I love you phrasing it that way, Noah. It's one very large building with kind of an aisled corridor on one side where, you know, you get head back to the kitchen and the practical areas. Julia not only designed that lovely kind of shingle-styled arts and crafts building in 1913, but years later she also designed the Saratoga Federated Church up the hill. Many a bride and groom have been married there and then walked down to the Foothill Club. for their reception. And it is, both of those buildings are beloved. And that is so typical of the buildings that Julia Morgan designed, is that their users adore them and feel so personally connected. And I'm thrilled for you. Congratulations on your upcoming nuptials. That's a wonderful connection you'll always have with that building, which has been beautifully maintained.
Yeah, thanks so much for sharing that.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Noah. Victoria, I wanted to read you a comment from one of our listeners. Did Julia Morgan ever talk to Hearst about the racist incarceration of Japanese Americans during World War II? I read in the book about the Japanese American woman who had worked for her, and Miss Morgan writing to the woman and her husband when they were sent to the Poston camp, and Miss Morgan purchasing them a home in Monterey County after the war.
That's all quite true. This was a woman named Sachi Oka, whom Julia hired when she thought she was a teenager. She was keeping a house, doing housekeeping for a family who lived on a larger home on the property. And Julia had bought herself a little hideaway, frankly, in 1934, because her health was fragile and she needed to be resting much more than she ever wanted to. And she ended up buying Sachi a brand new car. Sachi would pick her up from the train station in Monterey, and Julia didn't drive. She said, "Your car's really old," and she bought her a brand new Pontiac. And then, as you say, she and her husband, Kazuo, were interned during the war, and Julia sent them things they needed in Poston, Arizona. And after they got out in mid-war, they were going to move to Detroit, where they thought they'd get work with the auto industry. And Julia phoned Sachi and said, "I've bought you a house in Monterey near mine. Will you come home?" And she gave Sachi that house, where Sachi lived the rest of her life. And I don't know if she...
Well, and of course, all this just for context for listeners, yeah. You know, William Randolph Hearst newspapers are considered to have been a major engine of anti-Japanese sentiment, which is one reason why Kerry wanted to know, you know, given these two people, whether that was something that she approached William Randolph Hearst with.
Very good point. And I don't know if she did speak to him about that. There, by that time, by, you know, the middle of the 1940s, her health had gotten so fragile that she, though her handwriting is still on many of the drawings for San Simeon, where she worked for 28 years between 1919 and 1947, but there's much less correspondence. So I'm not aware of that. I do know that Hearst collected Japanese art, as did Julia, and Chinese art both. She gave the building that you first talked about, Alexis, the Berkeley City Club, whose magnificent pool that you referenced is on the cover of my book. She gave the Berkeley City Club as a gift a fabulous Chinese painting, and William Randolph Hearst, in memory of his mother, gave it a beautiful Japanese shrine. Hmm. But I don't know if they ever had a conversation about the treatment of the Japanese.
Yeah. Let's bring in Jim in Sonoma, California. Welcome, Jim.
Hi, Julia. We used to work together years ago. Talk about, if you would, Wintoon, and then Elsa Schilling's house at Lake Tahoe also has sort of a Wintoon look to it.
Yeah. What is Wintoon? This one is near Mount Shasta?
Yes, and it's spelled Wintoon, okay. And it was named for the native people of that region who were renowned for their feather baskets, the Wintoon. And W.R.'s mother, Phoebe, had hired Maybeck, and in 1902 he finished a magnificent, huge stone, really literally like a castle, like right out of Bavaria, building on the McLeod River at the base of Mount Shasta. It burned to the ground in 1930, and then Julia redesigned a Wintoon, and it's not something that's seen by the public, but the Hearst family members still use it, the Hearst Corporation still hold business meetings there. It's a compound of along this rushing river in three separate parts. One is this beautiful Bavarian village with little fairy tales, like just something straight out of Munich, Cinderella House and Brown Bear House and Angel House. These are charming structures. They're quite large, and they overhang, and their balconies, they overhang this rushing river. And as for the house in Lake Tahoe for Elsa Schilling, she was an heiress of the Schilling Spice Factory. And Julia met Elsa when actually they were both hospitalized. Julia for having chronic ear infections, and Elsa had been in a horse riding accident. So that's when they actually met each other, sometime around 1930. But she designed a beautiful house for her in Lake Tahoe that is also kind of that Bavarian looking. It has the fabulous carved wood, light wood interiors with arches and wonderful finish work inside. So it's interesting how many different styles Julia Morgan was comfortable in. And I think she learned about that, too, as having been a student at the École des Beaux-Arts, because she always studied the history of the past. Her buildings are very modern in a technological sense in terms of their infrastructure and functioning, but they are often garbed in this beautiful romantic language from every imaginable sort of past. And of course, we think of San Simeon, but there are many others as well.
Yeah. Let's bring in Kate from Inverness, who got to live in a Julia Morgan home. Welcome, Kate.
Thank you. I'm glad you brought up the simplicity, because the house that I lived in was five bedrooms, but it was very simply built. I love the doorway on the side. But what I loved the most was for a building designed by a woman, because it was a building designed by a woman, there was ample storage everywhere built in.
What else in the design of the home, was there anything in it that to you, you started to say to yourself, this is a Julia Morgan home and this is why I think that, or what makes me think that?
The respectful use of wood everywhere on the exterior. Yes, it was shingles on the inside. It was mostly redwood, but it had been whitewashed somewhat. But it was still beautiful, beautiful wood everywhere.
So nice. Thanks so much for that call, Kate.
Thanks for sharing, Kate. You know, people who have that privilege of living in Julia Morgan buildings or having done so talk about this incredible level of thoughtfulness and kind of anticipation of what a user would really need. And the wonderful thing about Julia Morgan buildings is if they survived the, and you know, she designed a 700, it's an incredible number, but she did design that many buildings, most of them in Northern California, nothing further east than Salt Lake City, but mostly in Northern California. But if they survived the 1960s and 70s, then they really haven't changed very much. That's true for her houses, and it's also true for the grand YWCAs, of which she literally built dozens, and women's clubs and public buildings, some of which we've been discussing, because they worked so well. People might have extended the kitchen, added on a bathroom or a closet or something, but basically the houses, when they have survived, they really look pretty much the way they did when she finished them, because they were so beautifully designed.
We've got a bunch of different fave buildings coming through. another favorite Julia Morgan building, the King's Daughter Home at 40th and Broadway in Oakland. Dan tweets to say, it's just such a surprise to come across this semi-hidden gem, which shows how active Ms. Morgan was locally. Daniel writes, my favorite Julia Morgan structure is around the corner from my house on Russian Hill. Remodeled sadly and badly by the recent owners, 1055 Green Street. Another listener on Instagram writes, on Piedmont Ave, there's a Morgan building, and a listener says, I'm lucky to work in that spot. You really get the history of it. When we come back, we're going to talk about two other very important Morgan buildings, Asilomar and Hearst Castle. We are talking with Victoria Kastner about her new book, Julia Morgan, an intimate biography of the trailblazing architect. And we are taking your questions and hearing about your favorite Julia Morgan buildings. You know, there are almost 700 of them scattered around the Bay Area. So give us a call. Favorite Julia Morgan building or questions you might have about them. The number is 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, it's KQED Forum. And the email, of course, is forum@kqed.org. I'm Alexis Madrigal. This is Forum. We're talking with author Victoria Kastner. Stay tuned for more right after the break.
This is Barbara Leslie, president of the Oakland Port Commission. Oakland International Airport, OAK, is proud to bring you this podcast of KQED's Forum. When you're choosing your next adventure, the smart and convenient choice is to fly the East Bay Way, from OAK to destinations across the USA and Mexico. And when you return home, tune in to KQED, always bringing us remarkable stories about who we are and where we live. Enjoy today's episode of Forum.
At Star One Credit Union, everything they do is in your best interests. They want to make banking easy and help your money grow. So Star One invests in technology to provide you with the best digital banking experience. Need a mortgage, auto, or solar loan? Their rates are stellar. At Star One, they're all about building lasting relationships by providing financial products and services that put you first. Become a member at starone.org or drop by any of their Bay Area locations. Star One Credit Union, in your best interest.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We're talking with Victoria Kastner about Julia Morgan. She's got a new book out, beautifully illustrated. It's called An Intimate Biography of the Trailblazing Architect. It's out from Chronicle. We need to talk about Hearst Castle. It occupied a lot of Julia Morgan's time, you know, hundreds of trips down to there from, you know, her life up here in the Bay Area. How do you evaluate the sort of artistic merit of Hearst Castle, especially given just like all of the mythology around William Randolph Hearst and just the sheer kind of opulence and scale of the thing?
It was a remarkable collaboration between client and architect, one of the longest ones in American history, actually. It went on for 28 years, the construction, and fortunately, it was very, very well documented. You know, there's a myth that Julia had burned her papers and that we will not know about her. The reason I wrote this book is that actually she saved literally thousands of letters, more than 2,000 that she exchanged just with William Randolph Hearst alone. And this is a book not just about her buildings, but about her private life and new things that I discovered about her private life for the first time. She had dealt with more adversities than I had realized and was more involved with caring for her family than I had realized, as well as all of the work that she did. But it is an amazing collaboration between these two people who on the surface seem very different. He's this lightning rod of controversy, this newspaper publisher, and she's, as one of her employee said, you know, she had a low voice, a clear, direct gaze, a very, very small, about 5'2". But this person said, I've seen grown men tremble when she said, no, it won't do. So she had a very equal relationship with William Randolph Hearst. He admired and respected her and deferred to her decisions. She admired and respected him and would, you know, kind of steer him. But really, she was good at depicting his taste. Obviously, it's very different from anything else she did, but it is spectacular. And together, these two, architect and client, were able to reach levels of creativity that they far greater than they did apart. And actually, neither one of them had a relationship that approximated this one in closeness in their lives. They weren't romantically involved. And indeed, Julia Morgan wasn't romantically involved with anyone, I don't believe.
That we know of.
We'll never know a person's entire private life. But I have transcribed with my assistant 800,000 words of her letters and to her and from her. And there's no long-term roommates. There's no traveling companions of either gender. You know, really, her romance was with architecture, you know. And one of the employees who worked on Hearst Castle and many of her other buildings, a Berkeley engineer named Walter Stahlberg, said about her with WR, when those two bent over a drawing, the rest of us could have been 100 miles away.
Mm-hmm. Sam in San Francisco has a question about project management at San Simeon.
Hi, I'm so glad I get to ask this burning question I've had forever. So there was obviously no ATMs. There was very little community in and around San Simeon. How the heck did she get these artisans in, paid, the materials in, up that hill? I cannot wrap around, you know, the idea that in my head, the idea of the practical day-to-day function of making this job site work. If you could fill me in on some of that, I would be so appreciative.
And Victoria Kastner, of course, was the official historian of Hearst Castle for 30 years. So I think you have, if anyone knows, Victoria?
Yes, and Sam, I'm so glad you brought that up. You know, this year is Julia Morgan's sesquicentennial. She was born 150 years ago on the 20th of January of 1872. That reminds us how long ago we're talking about this. In 1919, in the technology of the time, was when she began it. It was job number 503. But the incredible thing is that she would have designed hundreds of additional buildings while San Simeon was underway throughout the 20s and the 30s, and that when she began it, she couldn't vote in a federal presidential election. Mm. Women didn't have the vote. So it was remarkable. Now, she did have to build the road. The first time she went down there was by train, and Hearst expected her to ride horseback to the top of the hill. She looked at him. She said, I'm 47. I don't ride. That's not happening. So actually what they did, the first trip, and fortunately the taxi driver at the time documented this, his name is Steve Zagar, was that W.R. got on the horse at the bottom of the hill, and Julia stayed in the back seat of the taxi, and they called a couple of cowboys over, and he gunned the engine, and he drove it from sea level straight up to 1,600 feet at the top of that hill, avoiding these big rocks, and the cowboys rode alongside and roped the bumper. So this is like, it's not close now, but I mean, it was the backside of beyond in 1919. They had to generate their own power, which they did hydroelectrically. She put the water, the wiring all underground, you know, so it's very technologically advanced. Now, she had a crew that she took with her on jobs, generally speaking, and she brought a lot of them down to San Simeon. And she wrote to WR, she said, you know, he was paying higher than union wages. And she said, you know, I'm hiring countrymen as fast as I can because the men I brought down said the wages were good, the food was fine, but they didn't like being so far away from things. Mm. So actually the construction, which could be crews as many as 90 men on the hilltop, you know, were local people. But the artisans were largely from the Bay Area. And that made sense because during the week, Julia was running her business at the Merchants Exchange Building at 465 California Street. She opened that as her office in 1907 and remained there as her office until 1950. So the wood carving was being done on Polk Street. And the great tile setting of the indoor pool, which is known as the Roman pool, the one with the blue and gold glass tiles, those tiles of one-inch square mosaic glass were being laid out at the Club Fugazi on Green Street, if you've ever seen Beach Bank at Babylon. You know, Julia was in the Bay Area during the week, and so she could check in with the artisans. The tile, the beautiful polychrome, you know, fired ceramic tiles, those were being made at California Faience on San Pablo Avenue in Berkeley.
Man, so interesting. Such a deep connection to that place here that I had no idea about. Thanks so much for that question, Sam. A couple of comments to get to. Dan writes, we love College Avenue Presbyterian Church, the 1917 Julia Morgan Church on College Avenue in Rockridge, just up from the BART station. So simple and peaceful. We're restoring the building and hope to remove the unused pipe organ that was added later. If someone took the organ, it would uncover a wall of Julia-designed windows that haven't been seen in 100 years. So if you're out there and you're looking for a pipe organ, get in touch with the College Avenue Presbyterian Church. Lanny tweets, when I was young, family friends lived in a Julia Morgan house in the Oakland Hills, and my aunt and uncle lived in a Bernard Maybeck not far away. Sadly, both were lost in the Oakland Hills fire. Mm-hmm. There was, we had an amazing comment about suffragettes, but now I can't find it. Let's go back to the phones. Let's bring in Donna.
Hi, this is Donna. My husband and I, when we got engaged, I gave him a list of possible wedding venues. The list was full of Morgans and Maybecks because we both love their work. And my husband has his degree in architecture. He never got to actually work in architecture much, but that was what his degree was in. So we toured around the Bay Area to all of these gorgeous buildings. We settled on the Sausalito Women's Club. The day we went to look at this place was rainy, foggy, cold, couldn't see past the windows. But it was gorgeous. And I was like, this would be a fabulous place for our wedding if the weather's like this or if it's sunny. It turned out to be a gorgeous day. But it was just magical.
That building is so beautiful. I've gone to a wedding there, too, and it is just, man, you just, you never want to leave that building. It's just perfect.
It's very special. It overlooks the bay and has fabulous views. It looks like it's a rectangle, but actually it has about 18 sides and was very carefully designed by Julia to fit onto a complicated lot. But again, it's one of those beloved women's clubs. And just to comment quickly on the other thing, she did back women's suffrage and actually spoke about it publicly. There's this myth, as I said, that she burned her papers, and also a myth that she never took any public positions. It is true that she didn't like to be interviewed, and she did say that her building should speak. That was the way she preferred it, not she didn't like to write about architecture, lecture about it. You know, she just liked to design it. But she definitely backed women's suffrage and took public positions on it.
Hmm. Trish writes, at Cal, Julia Morgan was the sorority sister of suffragette Lucretia Watson, who married my grandfather, Benjamin Grant Taylor. As a wedding gift for Lucretia and B. Grant, Julia designed a beautiful craftsman home for them. The home was built in Saratoga, and when my grandfather became clerk of the California State Supreme Court and worked in San Francisco, it served as the family's weekend home. About 25 years ago, it was sold, and the purchasers had it updated a bit and moved slightly to accommodate subdivision of the property, but nothing has changed its original beauty. Julia Morgan truly was ahead of her time in so many ways. Steve in Berkeley actually has another way that she was perhaps ahead of her time. Welcome to the show, Steve.
Hi, thank you for having me. I live in a Julia Morgan since 1980 in Berkeley, and we're surrounded by several Julia Morgans. I was going to say that one of the lesser appreciated aspects of her houses, which are almost always warm and calming, are the use of sustainability. She has these, I guess you call it climate responsive design, so that she's using the sun's energy to keep the building comfortable and naturally ventilated. And in my house in particularly, there's a veranda which acts as sort of a natural, air conditioner in a way. One of the quirkier things, as many of us have had to redesign on our Julia Morgans, is that all her windows open in, which is kind of annoying, but
she thought it would make it easier to clean. That was why.
Okay.
That's so interesting.
Anyway, any comments on these breezeways and verandas that kind of connect the indoors to the outdoors?
Oh, yes. She was so known for this, Steve. Thank you. And that's true at San Simeon as well. You know, there always are breezeways, and the buildings retain both the cool and the heat beautifully. She was so practical in those ways. And I believe that's one of the reasons why in 2014, after, you know, a really long period of being almost forgotten, the American Institute of Architects posthumously awarded her their highest honor, which was the gold medal. I was one of
the first woman in 2014. I just wanted
that's
to
right. And the first woman in 100 years to receive that honor. I was one of the people on the nominating committee. And I have to say, I really didn't think that we would succeed, because I think she's been minimized. I don't think people had thought about things that your listeners are being so astute about bringing up, about sustainability and appropriateness, and also integrating. She loved not working with interior designers. She was the landscape architect and the interior designer at Hearst Castle herself. Just she and WR. They didn't have anyone else that they were really working with day to day. So she loved to take on all of these roles because she felt that it was all the same. And I know you mentioned, Alexis, that we were going to talk about Asiya Lamar. I just want to say that she did dozens of YWCAs, and these were very important for young women who were entering the workforce for the first time and needed a safe place to live that wasn't an unsavory boarding house full of traveling salesmen, you know. And she designed dozens of them, but she also designed this beautiful compound where they would earn money every year by bake sales and jumble sales and hay rides and things, to go for 10 days to Asiya Lamar, which, as your listeners know, is in Pacific Grove, south of Monterey. It means refuge by the sea. And Julia designed more than a dozen buildings there. But when she created her first YWCA, which was the one in Oakland, that still exists today on Webster Street. It was in 1913. It was based on a 16th century Renaissance palace in Italy, specifically. And she knew so well how to take historic references and integrate them into modern buildings. No one had ever considered that these young working women should be honored in that way. When she designed the residence, which is her 8-story high YWCA that is today still, housing in San Francisco, she designed little dining rooms so that the girls wouldn't have to all eat in one cafeteria together if they had private friends. And she was told, why do you do that? These are just for working girls. And she said, that's just the reason. She designed the Chinese YWCA, which is now the Chinese Historical Society in San Francisco. She designed the Japanese YWCA. She incorporated beautiful cultural references and she donated her services on at least one of those two, saying in honor of the contributions that these cultures have made to our city. She designed the NABE, N-A-B-E, in Potrero Hills District, which was for the Russian emigres. So she designed El Emanuel, which is now the Zen Center on Laguna and Page in San Francisco, but was a special residence for young Jewish women. Whomever she worked for, she honored, and often she did it without a profit. She would work for cost, or she would reduce her fee because she really loved what she did, and she loved the people for whom she worked.
Heidi just wants to make sure civil engineers get their props out there. Heidi writes, I'm curious why you focus on calling Julia Morgan an architect versus civil engineer. I'm a female civil engineer, so I'm curious about this. I appreciate her architecture skills, but it sounds like her engineering skills were amazing, too.
Well, Heidi, I would agree. Now, what happened was that she did study civil engineering at Cal and then really advance her knowledge at the École des Beaux-Arts. But except for doing the engineering and the reconstruction of the Fairmont Hotel, as time went on, she worked closely with consulting civil engineers. Walter Stahlberg of Berkeley was one. He's the one who engineered the building that you've mentioned, Alexis, the Berkeley, what was called then the Berkeley Women's City Club. It's now the Berkeley City Club, which has on its first floor this magnificent swimming pool with arches and perforated windows, the Gothic-style windows. What's interesting about it is it's the first floor of a 6-story high concrete structure. It's 46,000 square feet. So effectively, it would be like balancing a pile of bricks on a doily as far as trying to get the structure to support that weight when it was such a delicate first story. And she worked with a firm called Earl and Wright in San Francisco and a man named Walter Huber. Maybe many of you in the Bay Area know about Huber Park in El Cerrito Hills, which was named in his honor. But so she consulted with engineers later on in her career rather than engineering the buildings herself throughout her career. Yeah. But it was her knowledge of the technology of architecture that made her so effective.
Mm-hmm. We want to make sure people also know. Leslie writes in to say, I love Chapel of the Chimes on Piedmont in Oakland. And Marianne writes, Julia Morgan designed the mausoleum just outside the gates of Mountain View Cemetery in Oakland. We don't need to comment on it. It's just so beautiful.
That's one of my favorites, yeah. Leslie, for sure. A magnificent building. And folks, it's a columbarium, a mausoleum for crematory urns. It's open Monday through Friday. And if you have an opportunity, it's in North Oakland near the Mountain View Cemetery. Go. It is the most radiant, lyrical, consoling and calming structure. It's magnificent.
Yeah. You know, what do you think people should take away from Julia Morgan's legacy, just with our last few seconds of the show?
Well, having transcribed her letters, you know, to and from, we can actually do word searches, and Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, where her archives reside, is going to be posting these transcriptions so that scholars will be able to study her anywhere in the world. But since we can do word searches, we can look for words and know two occur very seldom, and those words are can't and cannot. She really did not think things were impossible. She had an endless sense of dedication to architecture, to beauty, to clients, and it is true that her buildings speak for her, but it's also true that she provides, with her strength and perspicacity, she gives us a lot of lessons in how not to be defined by limiting circumstances, how to live a full life and follow your truth even when it's difficult.
Thank you so much for this book and this hour. Victoria Kastner's new book is Julia Morgan, an intimate biography of the trailblazing architect. Thank you so much for joining us.
It was my pleasure, Alexis. Thank you.
And thank you, all of you listeners. The phones were on fire. That was incredible. So many comments. I'm sorry we couldn't get to all of them. We got to as many as we could, and they were awesome. I'm Alexis Madrigal. This is Forum. Stay tuned for another hour ahead with Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, and the Heising-Simons Foundation.
This is Barbara Leslie, President of the Oakland Port Commission. Oakland International Airport, OAK, is proud to bring you this podcast of KQED's Forum. When you're choosing your next adventure, the smart and convenient choice is to fly the East Bay Way from OAK to destinations across the USA and Mexico. And when you return home, tune in to KQED, always bringing us remarkable stories about who we are and where we live. Enjoy today's episode of Forum.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply, not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.